So I will start. I am Kyra Mann, CEO of Mito Action, and I am thrilled to have everybody with us today. We appreciate everyone taking the time to join us for this call. Today we have with us Dr. Guy Miller and Dr. Matthew Klein from BioElectron. Dr. Miller is the founder, chairman, and chief executive officer of BioElectron Technology, and they are focused on biological energy. He holds a PhD in chemistry and an MD with training in critical care, surgical internship at the University of Chicago, and completed his residency and fellowship training at Johns Hopkins, where he was an assistant professor. His research has been funded by numerous organizations, including DARPA. He is an attending physician in medical surgical critical care at Stanford University Medical Center. Dr. Klein is chief medical officer of BioElectron Technology. He received his MD from Yale University and completed his surgical training at Stanford University. He holds a master's degree in epidemiology. Sorry for that. Dr. Klein most recently held the David and Nancy Auth Washington Research Foundation Endowed Chair for Restorative Burn Surgery at the University of Washington, where he was a professor of surgery and epidemiology. His clinical and research expertise spans several fields, including skin biology, wound healing, systemic inflammatory disorders, clinical trials, and nutrition. He has authored and co-authored over 80 peer-reviewed manuscripts and 15 book chapters related to these areas. We are thrilled to have him with us today to give us an update on the EPI 743 study, and we are looking forward to hearing what's new in their world as it relates to mitochondrial medicine. So Dr. Miller and Dr. Klein, I turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you very much. Guy Miller here. So first, I'm sure folks are wondering, what is BioElectron and where did Edison go? So let me provide a little clarity there. And
then, the conference is now in silent mode.
So let me provide a little bit of clarity there, and then I'll turn things over to Matt Klein, who will walk through our status on 743. We're not getting smaller or changing our mission, we're just getting larger and growing our mission. When we started Edison, which evolved from a discussion that I had with several patient families and a foundation head in San Diego approximately 10 years ago, our mission was very simple, and it was that we thought that one of the most important areas of medicine, if not biology, was biological energy. And that if one could begin to understand how biological energy worked, that we could not only develop drugs for children who desperately needed them for what are termed mitochondrial diseases, but that we could make insights into some basic understandings of biology and begin to apply them. And I think many people in the mitochondrial community, and it certainly has been and is our guiding thought, knew that our mission revolved around a trilogy of fix children, learn, and apply. And now we're 10 years into that mission, and the good news is we have helped many children and adults with inherited mitochondria. We have made some significant learnings of how mitochondrial disease works, some of the basic underpinnings of biological energy and electron flow, also known technically as redox, in living systems. And we now have begun to apply that more broadly, not only to medicine, but other areas outside of medicine, including industrial biology. So this last January, our board of directors and advisors met and looked very closely at truly instantiating the mission of our company as it has always been, which is to fix children, learn, and apply. And as we're now applying much more broadly our technology, we felt that our name needed to reflect more accurately, publicly, the full breadth of our mission. We thought no better name for the company was BioElectron, in that what we have been doing all along is studying electrons or energy in biological systems, hence our new name, BioElectron. There's nothing different about our mission. It is just simply a name change. All the people who have worked here before, plus many more, are still resident. We're coming up close on almost 100 folks who are in our shop, spanning the disciplines of biology, chemistry, mathematics, physics, drug development, clinical science, molecular biology, medicinal chemistry. So we have a very large multidisciplinary team that's spending significant time and energy tackling the Fix Kids, Learn, and Apply mission of our company. Second, we've been asked by some people in the community why we have been relatively quiet over the last year or two. And sometimes Dr. Klein and I will say doing, as it were, nothing sometimes is the hardest thing to do. What we've been doing is collecting data. We've been talking to experts. We've been assembling a very deep and skilled science and technical advisory board, of which we'll begin to announce more formally in the next weeks ahead, which include a Nobel laureate in medicine and physiology. And we've been examining the best path forward. And so what Dr. Klein is going to outline are the challenges as we see them in the development of drugs, not only for rare diseases, but the unique pathology and biochemistry associated with mitochondrial diseases. We'll talk in some detail around the development status of EPI 743, and again, we'll kindly ask folks in the days and weeks ahead to refer to our new website, which will be fully annotated by the end of next week, with a multitude of new therapeutic candidates that are in our pipeline for the development of a broad array of not only mitochondrial diseases, but also adult neurodegenerative diseases, which have direct applications to mitochondrial disease. Dr. Klein will also talk about the general regulatory process that, of course, we must abide by. And we are very excited to see the change in posture, frankly, all throughout the world. The EMA has pioneered multiple ways, the European Medicines Agency, of gaining drug approval in rare diseases. We're now working, or through our colleagues, are working very closely with the Japanese equivalent in our Leigh syndrome trial in Japan called the PMDA. And as you would expect, we're in near constant discussion with the regulatory agencies and participants in the United States at the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. Just as recently as earlier this week, the new head of the FDA has enunciated a coming evolution of regulatory forbearances, or at least alterations that the community is probably waiting to hear, not the least of which are the drug development companies, around rare diseases, which we believe acknowledge the very challenges that Dr. Klein will review. And then lastly, we'll talk through our next steps, which is a keen understanding of the urgency to get 743 into a format with the appropriate regulatory structure that we can assist as many patients as possible. So with that introduction, let me turn things over to Dr. Klein, and at the end, we would be happy to field questions on any of the topics covered.
Hello, and thank you, Kieran, and the community for this opportunity to share our update. As Dr. Miller said, I'm going to go over the challenges in the development of drugs for mitochondrial disease, provide an update on the development status of EPI 743, explain where our development is in the context of the overall regulatory process to get a drug approved, and finally end by mentioning what our next steps will be. First, the challenges. When we set out to fix kids, learn, and apply, we were aware of many of the significant challenges for developing drugs for rare disease, and more specifically, mitochondrial disease. The first and probably most significant is the extreme heterogeneity of mitochondrial disease, even within each individual subtype, like Leigh syndrome or MELAS, there is a great deal of heterogeneity. There's differences in genetics, and there's differences in the clinical aspects of disease. For example, You could have two children with a diagnosis of Leigh syndrome. You could actually have two children with a SERF1 mutation causing Leigh syndrome. They may be very different in terms of their symptoms, their rate of progression, and their overall status of disease. These differences are due to not only traditional genetic inheritance issues, but the particulars of mitochondrial inheritance, including the concept of heteroplasmy. And so taken as a whole, we were faced with a very large challenge in trying to study a drug in children in whom no two had the same disease. And when your goal is to study a drug and show that it's effective, it's very difficult to do that when you have a whole group of children, each with different aspects of the disease, each at different stages of their disease, and each who are progressing at different rates. Next is the absence of a validated natural history. If you speak with regulatory authorities around the world, they will tell you the first thing you need before starting any drug program is to have a very well-detailed natural history of the disease that tells you when most people get diagnosed with the disease, what symptoms do they have, what is the rate of progression of that disease, and what are the most important symptoms to them, and what is the potential reversibility or slowing of those symptoms. These are all very important because when we go to design a clinical trial, we need to make decisions about who to include, what's known as inclusion criteria, know how long to study the drug's effect so that we can show that we're impacting the disease, and finally, know what are the most important endpoints or what are the common endpoints that we could target to show that we have made a difference in the way that the patient's disease unfolds. And so when you don't have comprehensive natural history, and keep in mind, again, we're talking about mitochondrial disease, where every different disease subtype, Leigh syndrome, MELAS, MRF, and every individual mutation within each of those different mitochondrial disease subtypes probably has its own natural history. And so when we say absence of natural history for a heterogeneous set of diseases like mitochondrial disease, that is really, really important. Next is the issue of absence of validated clinical trial endpoints. When you go to FDA and try to show them your data and convince them that you have a drug that is effective for patients, they would like you to have shown that it's effective against what they call a validated endpoint. That is an endpoint that's been used in previous clinical studies and has been used to help get drugs approved for that disease previously. Well, when you have no previous clinical trials done in mitochondrial disease, no drugs approved for mitochondrial disease, you're clearly not going to have validated endpoints. Let me give you an example by way of contrast. If we were trying to develop a drug for high blood pressure, it's very clear that the endpoint you would need to show is that someone's blood pressure goes down. And I think it's very clear in a disease like mitochondrial disease, we just don't have that metric yet. And that is a very big challenge as we try to collect clinical data and synthesize it into a clear message of how the drug is helping patients. Next, the challenge is related to patient logistics. Mitochondrial diseases are highly morbid diseases, and patients with mitochondrial disease are very ill. Sometimes they are in the hospital, sometimes they are at home but have a lot of equipment like wheelchairs and breathing assisting devices. And if we're conducting clinical trials at 3 or 4 centers in the country, it's just not possible for patients to get from Selma, Alabama to Akron, Ohio very easily. If it's a child who has a wheelchair and breathing devices, how does that actually happen? If there's other children at home, and it takes two parents to get a child from here to there, how does that happen if a child needs to be seen at a study site every month or every other month? And so what this does is when we try to organize clinical trials, it automatically eliminates a number of children or adults who may actually benefit from a therapy and whose experience in the clinical trial is very important. Next is the absence of clinical and regulatory precedent. As I said, not having previous clinical trials done in this area means that we don't have a set of endpoints that have been used and accepted by the FDA. And also, very importantly, when you go to talk to FDA and other regulatory authorities about Leigh syndrome or MELAS or MRF, if they've never had a drug approved for those diseases, they quite simply don't know what the disease is. And if you're going to have a discussion about getting a drug approved for Leigh syndrome with a group of people who just have never heard of the disease, you could imagine that there's a large educational component that needs to be in place that's just not there. And you could imagine as well, it is then very difficult to get alignment and guidance on how best to move forward in developing a drug for a disease that someone may never have heard of. The last two are disease rarity and disease severity. And I think it goes without saying that we all understand that mitochondrial diseases are rare and high and very severe in terms of the impact on patients. This rarity and severity makes all the other challenges I mentioned a lot greater. We simply don't have thousands of patients who can get enrolled in a clinical trial with any one specific disease subtype. We can't easily conduct large randomized controlled studies as if we were studying high blood pressure or diabetes, where we could enroll 1,000 or 2,000 patients, put them into two different groups, and then be able to look at different subtypes of disease and then be able to overcome some of the heterogeneity issues. We simply can't do that. Also, the fact that the disease is so severe and rapidly progressive means that even if there is a patient who might be able to participate in a trial, they may end up be at a point in their disease where they're so rapidly declining, they just can't get to a study site, get screened, get tested, and get enrolled and put into a trial. And so as we began our journey in developing a drug for mitochondrial disease, we were very aware of these challenges. And being that we are a company that has as its mission to fix kids, we made the decision that even though these challenges existed, we were going to move forward and start treating children and learning about our drug, learning about the disease, and start in parallel to address some of these challenges. And so we developed a clinical development strategy in which we would take our drug, EPI-743, and cast a broad net across many different mitochondrial disease subtypes and some other diseases that are very similar in terms of their biochemistry and pathology to mitochondrial disease, with the goals of, one, demonstrating that the drug is safe and well tolerated, which of course is the most important thing. Two, that the drug has what's called predictable pharmacology. That means we know that when we give a certain dose of a drug a certain number of times a day, it's getting into the body and it's getting to a level at which it should have an effect. And then third, be able to demonstrate that the drug has clinical benefit as measured against a whole number of different metrics. And so we moved forward with this phase two program with those goals. I'm now going to update you on the development status. So we are now have conducted 18 clinical trials and treated over 400 patients, ranging in age from 22 days to 69 years of life and living on six continents. We have now provided over 1 million clinical doses of EPI-743 and can clearly state that the drug has demonstrated to be safe and well tolerated, even in the most ill children. We have also succeeded in demonstrating that the drug has predictable pharmacology, and we are comfortable that we have a dose that is both safe and effective for children. And finally, we have recorded in several clinical studies clear evidence of clinical benefit as recorded across a number of metrics that are relevant to patients with mitochondrial disease. And so as we look at the overall regulatory status of EPI-743, we have now completed our phase two program. And if we look at the four components needed for a new drug application, the non-clinical, the chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, the regulatory and clinical, we have now accumulated necessary data to fulfill each of those portions. We have a complete non-clinical package. We have a agreed upon with the regulatory authorities process for manufacturing the drug. We have had the necessary regulatory guidance, interactions, and support for the development of the drug. And finally, as I mentioned, we have now collected a body of evidence across the world, across the trials we've conducted around the world, that has demonstrated a beneficial effect of the drug as measured by a number of different important endpoints. And so what are our next steps? Our next steps are to translate these signs of clinical benefit that we've observed, along with the large body of evidence demonstrating that the drug is safe and well tolerated, into making EPI-743 available to patients who may benefit from its treatment. We have clearly articulated the challenges to you all, many of which I'm sure were known, that we have faced in the development of a drug for mitochondrial disease. And we're not alone. We know that many others have been in this position of developing a drug for rare diseases. And we're going to now move forward and work closely with the FDA, as well as regulatory authorities in Europe and in Japan, to define the optimal path forward to get EPI-743 approved. And let me finish on that note, and we can open it up if anyone has any questions that we can answer.
Wow, thank you so much. I mean, both of your dedication to the lives of helping mitochondrial families, it's been, I know, a lifelong, many-year dedication for you guys, and just from our whole community, we really thank you. And I know many people call in just to, you know, get a glimpse of what might be out there. It gives us such hope for the future and for our kids and for ourselves and for future generations. So I just want to be the first to say thank you so much. At the beginning of the call, I'm not sure that everyone heard that my name is Mary Beth Hollinger. I'm the Director of Education Support and Advocacy. I love participating in these presentations because I always learn something, and I just love being able to bring like this cutting-edge information to our community. So thank you again, doctors. And I wanted to let everyone know that you can ask questions. Either we'll open it up live, or you can email me a question, and I can ask it for you if you think it's a better venue. So the best email would be mito411@mitoaction.org, and you can, you know, email me your question and I will voice it for you. I just ask people to keep it general, not super specific, just because the call is recorded and you may not want your details or your child's details, you know, out for everyone. But I will open it up with a question about the way that we have always, the FDA has used to evaluate drugs, and now we're coming up against a relatively new disease, which definitely does not fit the rules of all the old diseases with all the parameters that, you know, I may have muscle weakness, but person Y might have just eye issues, or someone else may have seizures. So do you think that the FDA needs to change, like fundamentally, how they evaluate drugs, given that, you know, we learn more genetically on a cellular level, that not all diseases sort of fit in that box?
Yeah, I mean, I'll field that one, Guy Miller here. We have to say we've had great interactions with the FDA. I, you know, gently remind the mitochondrial community that in 2009, on the basis of the rarity of mitochondrial disease and truly only a laboratory piece of data, the FDA issued out an expanded access IND with amazing urgency to do two things. One, to make available 743 from a regulatory perspective as fast as possible to help as many patients within 90 days of the end of life. And they took extraordinary attention to mitochondrial disease at a rate of action, which certainly in my experience was unparalleled, a turnaround time of one day. And frankly, immense within the structure, of course, of regulatory guidance and surveillance and all the things that we do, immense risk. Drug had not yet gone through all full phases of clinical development, but yet the risk-benefit was clearly seen by the FDA and our expert advisors. So I would say that the FDA certainly has a keen appreciation of the urgency and severity of these diseases. The challenges that Dr. Klein laid out are challenges that we all face. They're not simply regulatory challenges. They're challenges that clinicians face every day. There are, of course, challenges that patients and families face. And so we look at these as a collective set of challenges that we all have to begin to develop solutions for. Is the FDA immune to that set of challenges and problems? No, not at all, but neither are any of us. And so I think the way we would frame our thoughts around the FDA, PMDA, and EMA is that they're not quite as adversarial or obstructionist as people might make them out to be. At least it certainly has not been our experience, number one. Number two, this is just a hard problem. The challenges that Dr. Klein laid out are real. And they are difficult. And, of course, we all want to make sure that any drug that would come to market in any of the regulatory structures would first and foremost do no harm. And those requirements are very clear, and, of course, we support them. So I think the BioElectron experience with FDA, we would rate it as being positive. The challenges we all face are there, but we would also see that the FDA has expressed from the get-go an immense sense of urgency in the mitochondrial community, certainly in working with us, to expedite as quickly as possible treatments for children with rare mitochondrial disease. I will also add that this is not idiosyncratic to one division. In a program that we are working with the ophthalmology division, our turnaround time on weekends for getting patients enrolled in compassionate use trials were sometimes as fast as 13 minutes with personal phone numbers of regulatory individuals in those various groups. So we feel a very positive sense of partnership with the FDA, and I think we both respect the missions and challenges of our organizations.
Wow, thank you. Perfect. I've had a few more questions come in, so I will continue before I open up the lines. One caller asked, will you be seeking approval for Epi 743 in LHON or just for other mitochondrial diseases?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me use that as a jumping off point for one of Dr. Klein's comments about patient heterogeneity, which is end endpoints. One of the reasons we were drawn to Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, sometimes called LHON, was the seeming objective sense of vision. What we learned over the course of about 5 to 6 years is that while vision certainly is objective, the subtleties of the differences of loss of vision in Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy do not mirror other well-known diseases such as, for example, macular degeneration, number one. Number two, the interpatient variability, as our advisors in Dr. Sudun and Dr. Valerio Corelli in Bologna said that there really are no typical patients with LHON. And so while we attempted to identify select patient populations that perhaps would mitigate some of these challenges, we learned rapidly that at least our experience at BioElectron has been that these challenges extend to virtually all of the diseases, whether they're mitochondrial optic neuropathies or systemic diseases. Notwithstanding, we're looking very closely at what's going on in gene therapy and fertility therapy with regards to genetic engineering of mitochondria, the so-called three-parent babies. We're looking very closely at the work that's been done by Synthera in adipinone and how we can avail ourselves of this very strong dossier of preclinical and clinical work to expedite various programs that we're undertaking here. So a fairly detailed answer to what we would succinctly say is we are very interested in mitochondrial dysfunction of the retina and the eye, and we're looking very closely at how, when we're developing second-generation drugs, we can advance them forward.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thanks for that question. Again, if you'd like to email me a question, mito411@mitoaction.org, and I can voice it for you. I have a question from Laura, actually two questions. Could you ask them to specify how they're going to define that optimal path forward? What would that path be if they could have their wish? Ooh, you've been granted a free wish. But I think the bottom line is we all want to help, you know, help that path, help construct that path as best we could from our patient advocacy standpoint. So, you know, the second part is how can the patients and the advocacy groups help you, you know, along that path?
That's a great question. We like that question. As a matter of fact, Laura, if you have a wand there, we're going to ask you to wave it for us. Look, I think the wish we have is, of course, the wish of the community. And as our founders, who we've said many times, both publicly and in person, that our job is to see them live a long, productive life with, in this case, their children. So we have the same ultimate wish that I'm sure Laura has for either herself or her family members or others. With regards to the regulatory path, I think, frankly, the wish I would say we have is that the individuals that today are inside the Japanese FDA and are inside the Food and Drug Administration today, who have took note of the 10 or so challenges that Dr. Klein elaborated on, and have been able to make clear that the hypothesis-driven approach with a randomized controlled trial that works so efficiently for large homogeneous diseases is just simply not applicable to rare heterogeneous diseases in the absence of agreed upon endpoints whose natural history by virtue of the advances of medicine is simultaneously changing while drugs are being developed, compounded by the extreme rarity of these diseases, requires a new way to make medicines available to these populations. We have been advocating this from the very beginning of the path of Edison, and these points have been enunciated sometimes under, shall we say, frank discussions around why these diseases are different and need different paths towards their approval. I would say, to answer Laura's question directly and transparently, what we would love to see happen is a safe and vigilant path forward to approval based on the body of data that's been collected to date, and a very clear way to demonstrate, as has been done in multiple other settings, that first and foremost, safety and tolerability is as stated in the body of data that's been gathered, and that a growing means to assess clinical and meaningful benefit is developed, as we have in the expanded access trial and in other areas, as the drug is being exposed to more people who can benefit. So that would be our wish to the agencies, and I think the good news is the FDA and the patient communities and others are beginning to understand that the path that we have been advocating and that we hope will be embraced now becoming, I'm not sure I'd say mainstream, but let's just say relatively common. To Laura's second question as to how the patient community can help, we are indebted to the patient community. Of course, without the foundations, Edison would have never been formed. Without patients and patient involvement, Edison never would have been formed. We are passionate doctors and scientists from all different walks of medicine. And while we, of course, appreciate the severity of the disease and want to make that impact, the passion of developing drugs and therapeutics is what we do. And so I think first and foremost, we need patient participation. While it is very laborious and tedious to be involved in natural history studies that are being directed by the NIH, the UMDF, Dr. Hirano, and others, and people all over the world attempting to collect a systematic understanding of these diseases, it is essential that the patient community participate in not only clinical trials, that they fulfill the criteria for, especially given the rarity, but that they participate in these exceedingly laborious and detailed natural history studies as they come online, so that we can further understand the truth of these diseases, not the anecdotal reports, but to get prospective understanding of not only the clinical features of these conditions, but also the patient-reported outcomes of these conditions. And as new tools and technology become available, the detailed biochemistry and molecular basis of these diseases. I think Laura's question probably was more towards what can the mitochondrial community do to facilitate approval. I think the short answer is that burden is on our shoulders. We, of course, will reach out to the mitochondrial community as we begin to build the regulatory dossier, as the investigators do that in terms of their clinical trial assessments. But at the end of the day, the responsibility for gaining approval will be on our shoulders.
Okay. It's not an easy path to forge, I guess. We can all see that. I just wanted to review for 1 minute the difference between a clinical trial and a natural history study. Would you like to just explain that in a little bit of detail for our callers?
Yeah. So a clinical trial is effectively, and there are many types of them, and they come under very many different forms, but the intent of a clinical trial is to assess how a subject responds to an intervention. And that intervention can be walking up a flight of steps, the intervention can be a device, the intervention can be a drug, the intervention could be a drug and a device, the intervention could be a diagnosis and behavior. So it is just simply a means to study a perturbation of a system with some knowledge of the control of the system. And that control can take many different forms. It can be merely an observation that's anecdotal. Grandma looks better now that she swims in the pool. That's a clinical trial. Now, how reliable a clinical trial, certainly open to debate. The types of trials that we would all love to see conducted are what are called randomized control trials, RCTs. Sometimes the gold standard referred to as a placebo-controlled trial to remove any sense of hypothesis-based bias in the design of that trial. That activity differs from natural history in that a natural history in the perfect world, it is merely observational. And what you're doing is to collect data on subjects over time and merely being an astute observer, God willing, without interfering in the collection of the data. So an optimal clinical trial, an optimal observational trial, which would be archetypal, would be one that the participant would be, as it were, invisible to the observer, and the data collected would have zero impact on how, in fact, the participant was behaving. A natural history study that's problematic is when the observers and the participants are interrelated, and the natural history that's being collected doesn't truly reflect what goes on in the disease. And so the two types of studies are to gather an understanding of how a disease evolves over time, a natural history study, and a clinical study is to understand how an intervention impacts a subject enrolled in a study.
Thank you for that clarification. And the easy part about the natural history studies is that you're right, there's many of them around, and we can all participate and get sort of that line of how this disease looks, acts, all the variability, so that the understanding of the disease increases. So thank you for that clarification. I do have another question from Carol. She would like to know how Epi 743 has helped patients, like more specifically, if you had any sort of stories or, you know, traumatic patients, like what dysfunctions improved? Bring it to life a little bit.
Yeah, I think the best way to probably answer that is I'll ask Dr. Klein to send over to folks at MitoAction the peer-reviewed publications that have appeared in a multitude of diseases, starting with Dr. Enz's publication on the initial 29 subjects who received EPI 743, and all the way to studies and abstracts that have been presented on RARS2, a mitochondrial seizure disorder, as well as a publication that's being prepared right now describing the experience we've had with 743 and Friedreich's ataxia, as well as Parkinson's disease and others. So we'll send those over and folks can look at them because they're detailed and they describe in depth the limitations to studies, endpoints that were targeted and achieved or not achieved, and what was learned during the course of phase two development. And that will serve as a much more foundational answer to your question. But notwithstanding that, I think what we would say today, and our principal investigators, advisors, and community, as well as regulators, would agree, is that we have seen unambiguous signs of clinical benefit. Now, whether those unambiguous signs of clinical benefit can be achieved in a randomized controlled trial that would suffice for a large homogeneous disease that is not of orphan nature with a known natural history and instantiated endpoints is a separate question. But I think the general impression of the clinical investigators who have conducted the studies is that clinical benefit has ranged on virtually all organ systems in a variety of clinical settings. The one we have most recently focused on is built upon a body of data which has been obtained at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, looking at the morbidity associated with Leigh syndrome, in particular around hospitalization and severity of disease. And they have conducted an extensive review on mitochondrial disease, how it progresses and its association with hospitalizations and the morbidity or unfortunate outcomes associated with the disease. And what we have observed in our Leigh syndrome trial in the United States, as well as in Europe and in Japan, is an unequivocal reduction in hospitalizations associated with those patients who have been in the treatment arms of the trial. So I think we're prepared to say that subject to the same types of forbearances that the agency is aware of and has been understanding of with other regulatory submissions, that we're meeting an analogous level of evidentiary requirement.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And the people who have emailed me questions are already writing back to thank you for your detailed and right on-point answers. So I just want to give you that feedback as well. I think we should open up the lines, and I can go back to emailed questions. So again, mito411 at mitoaction.org. You can send me a question if you feel that's a better way to get your question answered. But I'll open up the lines for now, and then I can go back to the emailed questions. So don't give up on me yet. So when I unmute the phones, just be aware all that background noise will come into play, and you can mute your own phone by using *6 or your mute key. So here I go, unmuting.
Chris is now in talk mode.
Okay, is there anyone who would like to ask either of the doctors a question?
Yes, I do have a question.
Okay, go ahead, Irina.
Yes, I'm wondering what is being done about the shortage of doctors who see adult patients with mitochondrial disease. And I'm not talking about adult onset. I'm talking about being a survivor since childhood and really needing more assistance with a mito expert doctor, especially in, one would wish, in the Stanford area.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. It's a little bit outside of our power alley to be able to answer what is being done, but I can tell you we are observing the same phenomena. You know, we live in a different world right now. You know, there are votes going on in Washington talking to the allocation of healthcare resources. If we haven't figured out how to allocate healthcare resources in diabetes, obesity, heart attack, and stroke, I think as a practicing physician at Stanford, I can stand on firm ground to tell you we certainly haven't figured it out for myeloencephalopathy, lactic acidosis, and stroke. We certainly haven't figured it out for Leigh syndrome. We certainly
I'm
haven't figured it out.
Talking about somebody who's got really good insurance. It's not an insurance issue.
Yeah, no, I agree. But the problem is that the intra-hospital resources about specialization are so encumbered with the economics of healthcare practice in the United States that the ability of hospitals to set up clinics, to bring on board expanded faculty programs, to conduct research that is critical, is greatly constrained in the United States. We are constantly reminded by our Japanese and European colleagues about the fundamental differences in healthcare practice in and throughout Europe versus Japan versus the United States. So I think what I can say, Irene, to you is that we feel the same thing. We would like nothing more than to see more doctors, more specialists, more clinics, and frankly, more dedicated institutes such as that are being set up, for example, at CHOP and Professor Wallace and others who are pioneers and still continue to pioneer the work going on. I'm sure I'll omit because there's just many of folks who are working on this. Obviously, Bruce Cohen, the folks in Texas.
Dr. Cohen no longer sees adult patients. Can
I? This is Dr. Kira. I'm on the call. Can I answer this question?
Yes.
Certainly.
Hi. So I'm an internist and I see adults at Mass General, but I wanted to let you know that we are actively working on this issue. The Mitochondrial Medicine Society, in collaboration with the UMDF, Mitoactin, and the Foundation of Mitochondrial Medicine, we have been working on this for the past year, trying to establish centers of excellence for mitochondrial diseases in the U.S., and we're also working on establishing affiliate clinics. So those would be people that we would like to train that will be serving community hospitals and be outside of tertiary academic centers. So we understand that this is a very urgent need, and we're making sure that these centers have a good transitional care system for those pediatric patients that outgrow the pediatric system and have good adult support as they grow older, and also for the adult patients who I know are very underserved in mitochondrial diseases. So we are working on this. We're going to talk more about it at the UMDF meeting next week, and hopefully we will have some concrete things to set up by next year.
Okay. One thing that I noticed in Europe, the doctors use Skype a lot to be in contact with their patients who have rare diseases, who perhaps live in outlying areas. They don't live in a center, but they're followed by a doctor in a major center via Skype. So they do regular consultations with the patient. Is that something that would be considered illegal in the United States system?
No, so we're going off topic here because this was really dedicated to the to BioElectron. But yes, that system exists in the U.S. and there are more and more hospitals using it. But I'm happy to talk more to you about this through offline.
Okay, and how would I reach you offline?
Through MitoAction.
I mean, you can contact me and I can help you with that. So I know that you can just use the MITRE 411 address and I will help you with that.
All right.
But thank you for your question. Does anyone else have a live question to ask? And thank you, Dr. Kara, very, very, very much.
Welcome.
Okay, I have a question that came in about dysautonomia and mitochondrial disease and studies, but I will contact you directly and help you figure out how to use the website to help with clinical trials. And there was one other question that came in. Someone was asking about compassionate use and how exactly that works in our rare community for these, you know, drugs that are not quite through the FDA as of yet.
Yeah, the FDA has multiple vehicles, as it were, where patients can gain access to drugs prior to approval. Let me not attempt to explain each one of them, because sometimes there's an evolution of thinking, but they include vehicles such as compassionate use, in some cases expanded access programs, where as opposed to individuals being granted access on a case-by-case basis, as is with more typical with compassionate use, there can be a more blanket availability. There are also vehicles such as treatment, INDs, where there can be a modicum of reimbursement to companies as they are making the drug available through clinical testing. So I think the general question is, how can you gain access to a drug prior to it being approved? And those are, in general, the ways that one does that. If the question is more to the point, is there an expanded access compassionate program that is open right now for EPI 743? The answer is no, there is not. We enrolled numerous subjects, I think probably close to 100 subjects in the expanded access / compassionate use in the 2009 IND. At this point in time, we simply do not have sufficient drug to be enrolling subjects further into that study. But certainly as we're beginning to get more clarity on drug synthesis and availability for commercial production, we would anticipate that being a significant part of a approval process.
Great, thank you. I'm going to shout out one more time. Does anyone have a final question for either of the doctors?
Hi, my name is Dr. Susan Bevan. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, all right, thank you. And I am family practice and functional medicine. And this, Dr. Kara, was something, I'm going to the conference and would enjoy meeting you. I've talked to several of my functional medicine colleagues who are interested in treating adult mitochondrial patients. So I'll be reaching out to you and look forward to meeting you in person to discuss this further.
Oh, definitely.
All right, great. In closing, I think the final question I will ask, and this has come to me as well through the internet, but they would like to know what is the best way to obtain a copy of the study results when they are available? Is this something that you will make available so that we can all, you know, either through MitoAction or another venue? What's the best way for us to get our hands on that?
Yeah, we've been asked that question by several people. I mean, the classic way, which is the way we will suggest that that's done, is through peer-reviewed publication. And we're working right now with our principal investigators in drafting the summaries of these collective experiences. The clinical studies in each of these conditions have a fairly lengthy, what are called extension periods, which we think are critical to the full evaluation and to gain a proper perspective on the treatment or absence of a treatment effect. And so one of the questions we've been asked is, if a clinical trial runs 6 months, how come there isn't a study report in 6.5 months? And we would have a caution, which is that while the placebo portion of a clinical trial can run 6 months, the extension phase of the trial can run an additional 1 or 2 years. And so the desire that we have is to not issue out premature data, but to have as complete a data set that we can generate as was envisioned in the design of these trials. And so in each of these circumstances, we will do what's industry standard and customary, which is to submit the results for peer review publication.
Perfect. Well, thank you. And Dr. Miller, Dr. Klein, on behalf of MitoAction and Kyra, we just really want to thank you for giving us your time this morning for you, but this afternoon for some of us. I'm sure we've all learned a lot, and it's really opening our eyes to that whole path and some of those bumps in the road or pitfalls that slows things down in a rare disease. So I just, again, want to thank you for your continued, you know, fight for mitochondrial disease and getting something, you know, that will help all of us that is safe and effective because we definitely know how important safety is, especially with our kids. So really, just thank you so much for your time.
Y'all are amazing. I just had to put that out
they
there.
They truly are. They are not doing this for the money, or else they
know.
Much easier disease with much easier endpoints. So, holy cow, thank you guys so much.
Yes.
Mary Beth, if I could just, this is Kyra. I just want to echo Mary Beth's thanks to Dr. Miller and Dr. Klein for your passion. We really can't thank you enough for all you do for the community. And I want to reiterate, you know, MitoAction, we will continue to stay engaged with BioElectron to continue to understand how we can advocate and take an active role in moving the path forward and what's appropriate for us to be involved with. And we'll continue to share that information with the community so that we can ensure that the patient's voice is continued to be heard in the process.
That's wonderful. And, you know, of course, we've got a whole big shop here of people who feel as passionate as we do. I know that Dr. Klein and I leave these calls. We're not on the frontier of treating patients with mitochondrial disease. And we always leave these calls both with a very quiet demeanor of purpose and yet again reminded, you know, how important the work is that we're all undertaking. I think in the response that I made with regards to the FDA is that I think we're all in this boat together, and we know that we're standing on the shoulders of giants, starting with Billy DeMauro and first discussions that we've had with him and Eric Schoen to lead investigators all over the world. And we're very cognizant that EPI-743 is not the best drug that this company will produce. But we are very cognizant that we have to start with a first drug. And from that, we will learn and iterate and become smarter each day. And many more people will come into this field to build upon, God willing, the work that we were a part of setting in motion. And so I think it's a virtuous cycle that we're looking to get started with gaining 743 access more broadly into the patient community, which we're ready to champion. And we certainly can't do it without the full support of all the stakeholders in the community.
Great. Well, thank you again, and thank you all for calling in. We will we have recorded this call, and we will put it up on our website. So if another family member missed it, they will have an opportunity down the line to catch up with what's new and what all the work that BioElectron is doing.